I have to admit, I had a bit of a moment the other day.
Oh, yeah.
I was stuck in traffic on this massive highway overpass, and I'm looking out at the steel girders holding me up, and I got this sudden wave of, I guess you'd call it structural anxiety.
Structural anxiety, is that an official diagnosis now?
It should be. I started thinking about what's actually holding those beams together. It's just a weld,
Huh,
right?
yeah.
A line of melted metal. And when we think of welding, we think of this brute force, industrial thing, sparks, heat.
It feels mechanical, like you're using a hot glue gun, but for steel.
A hot glue gun. That's exactly it. But then I started reading the research for this deep dive, and I realized how wrong that mental image is. If you zoom in, and I mean way, way in a weld, is this chaotic, high-speed metallurgical event.
It is incredibly violent at the microscopic level. You're
Yeah.
taking solid steel, melting it, mixing in chemicals, and then freezing it all in seconds.
You're creating a miniature casting,
A
basically.
tiny foundry in a teacup, under conditions that are almost impossible to control.
And the result of that chaos, the microscopic structure that forms, that determines everything.
Everything. It determines if that bridge holds up or if a gas pipe bursts.
So that's the mission for this deep dive. It's a big one. Can we predict, truly predict, what that structure will look like before anyone even strikes an arc?
That is the holy grail of metallurgy. And to explore it, we're going back to a landmark paper from 1987.
Okay.
It's called Prediction of Microstructure of the Fusion Zone of Multicomponent Steel Weld Deposits by Badesia and his team.
1987. I know that sounds like ancient history to some people listening. I mean, pre-internet ancient.
For sure.
But in physical metallurgy, this is foundational stuff. This is the bedrock.
It really is. And before we get carried away with the word prediction, I want to set a tone here.
Okay.
We have a rule for this deep dive, measured analysis.
Because it's so easy to look at a model like this and just say, it's magic. It sees the future.
But it's not magic. It's rigorous phase transformation theory. We're not going to claim they solved welding forever. We're going to look at how they took a messy, dirty process.
And applied strict physical laws to it.
Exactly. Bringing order to chaos.
No magic, just math. I love it. Okay, so let's visualize the problem. We're in the fusion zone.
Yeah.
Paint the picture for us.
Okay, so the welding arc has just passed by. The metal has melted into this liquid pool. As the heat moves away, that pool starts to cool.
And it freezes.
It solidifies. And it begins right at the fusion boundary, the edge where the liquid meets the solid.
And this is where the architecture gets built. The paper says the first thing that happens is the liquid turns into delta ferrite, then austenite. But they use a very specific geometric description for these austenite grains.
They do, and this geometry is crucial. They describe the morphology as a honeycomb of hexagonal prisms.
A honeycomb. That seems orderly. I was expecting jagged rocks or something. Why hexagons?
Nature loves efficiency. Think about bees, right? If you want to pack cylinders together with no wasted space, what shape do they squish into?
Hexagons.
Hexagons. So just imagine a bundle of hexagonal pencils packed tight. That's your austenite grain structure.
Okay, got the bundle of pencils.
Now, mathematically, these prisms have a side length, A, and a length, C. But the orientation is what matters. The long axis, C, grows parallel to the heat flow.
So the grains are literally reaching away from the heat.
Exactly, as it cools.
So we have these long columns. Now, here's where the model does something that I thought was really clever, but is it kind of cheating? The authors say because C is so much larger than A, we can just ignore the ends.
It feels like cheating, doesn't it? But it's a classic engineering simplification, a geometric assumption. If the prism is basically infinitely long compared to its width, you don't have to worry about the complex 3D stuff happening at the tips. You can treat the whole problem as a 2D cross-section.
So you just slice the pencil in half and look at the hexagon.
That's it. You only need to solve for what happens inside that hexagon as it cools. It turns a 3D computational nightmare into something that was actually manageable in 1987.
Okay, fair enough. Efficiency wins. So the stage is set. We have our austenite honeycomb, but it's not stable, right? As the temperature drops, it wants to change again.
That's right. Austenite is the high temperature phase. As the weld cools, the crystal structure wants to rearrange itself. It decomposes.
Into different types of ferrite.
Yes, and this is where the paper gets so interesting because it treats these different microstructures almost like competing species in an ecosystem.
Just survival of the fittest, or maybe survival of the fastest.
Precisely. They're all battling for space inside those hexagons.
Let's meet the cast of characters then. The first one is allotriomorphic ferrite, alpha. I've nicknamed this one the squatter.
The squatter. I haven't heard that one. Why?
Well, look at where it forms. It nucleates. It starts growing right at the boundaries of the austenite grain.
At the walls of the honeycomb.
Yeah. It doesn't go into the middle. It just camps out on the edges.
That's accurate. The grain boundaries are high-energy areas. They're chaotic, so it's the easiest place for a new phase to start.
And how does it grow?
It uses a diffusional transformation mechanism, which means for the structure to change, atoms, specifically carbon atoms, have to physically move. They have to diffuse through the crystal lattice.
So it's like walking through a crowded room. You have to bump past people.
Exactly. And because of that, it's relatively slow. It just forms these layers along the walls that thicken over time.
And the paper uses a specific term for this growth, the parabolic thickening rate constant, alpha 1.
Yes, and parabolic is the key word. A parabola on a graph starts steep and then flattens out.
Meaning it grows slower as it gets thicker?
Precisely. Mm. Because the commute for those carbon atoms gets longer. As the ferrite layer thickens, the carbon it rejects has to travel further away into the remaining austenite.
So it grabs the prime real estate, but then it slows itself down.
Which opens the door for the next character, the aggressor.
Widmanstetten ferrite, alpha.
Widmanstetten is a completely different beast. It doesn't just sit on the wall. It grows from those boundary layers and shoots straight into the grain.
And it uses a different mechanism, a displacive mechanism.
Undisplacive, it sounds more violent. And it is. It's much faster. Instead of atoms diffusing randomly, the crystal structure shears. It just snaps into a new shape.
Like a deck of cards sliding.
Perfect analogy. It creates these long, sharp, plate-like structures.
So it's a shapeshifter. Snap, and it's done.
Well, almost. It wants to be that fast.
Yeah.
But there's a catch.
There's always a catch in thermodynamics.
Always. Even though the shape changes fast, it's still limited by chemistry. As these ferrite plates grow, they push carbon atoms out of the way. But they grow so fast, the carbon piles up at the tip.
Okay, I need another analogy.
Imagine a nightclub. The Widmanstetten plate is a line of people trying to rush the fire exit. They can run fast. That's the displacive part. But if there's a crowd outside blocking the exit...
That's the carbon.
That's the carbon that gets stuck in the bottleneck.
So its growth is rate controlled by how fast that carbon can diffuse away. It's a sprinter that's forced to jog.
Exactly.
Okay, so we have the wall huggers slowing down because of distance and the sprinters slowing down because of traffic jams, but there's still space left in the middle.
And that's where the third character comes in, a acicular ferrite, alpha.
The insider.
The insider. It's unique because it doesn't care about the grain boundaries at all. It nucleates on nonmetallic inclusions, tiny bits of oxide, basically trapped inside the grain.
This is usually the hero of the story, right? In modern steel, this is what we want.
We do, because it grows from the inside out in every direction. It creates this chaotic interlocking pattern, like a basket weave.
A basket weave? That sounds strong.
It is. If a crack tries to travel through the steel, it can't just follow a straight line. It hits this maze of acicular ferrite and gets arrested. It stops the crack dead.
So in this model, it's basically what fills the volume the other two didn't take.
The leftovers, but the good kind of leftovers.
Now, the paper also mentions microphases like perlite or martensite, but they basically say, let's ignore them for now.
Well, not entirely ignore them. They acknowledge they exist, but they treat them as the tiny fraction that's left at the very end. For this model, they're just filling the gaps. It's a pragmatic choice.
Right. You'd never finish the calculation otherwise?
Not in 1987.
Okay, let's get into the model's logic. We have our characters. How does it decide who wins? What does it actually do?
The beauty of this model is its minimalism. It just needs two main inputs. First, the chemical composition.
So how much carbon, manganese, silicon, and so on.
Exactly. And second, the welding conditions, specifically the heat input.
That's it. You don't have to look under a microscope first?
No, that's the prediction part. The whole engine runs on phase diagram calculations. It uses something called peri-equilibrium tie lines to figure out the thermodynamic rules for that specific mix.
And it generates these curves. TTT and CCT curves, they look like big C shapes on a graph.
Right. Time temperature transformation. You have a graph, x-axis is time, y-axis is temperature, you get two C curves. The upper one is the diffusional stuff, the slow allotriomorphic ferrite.
And the lower curve?
That's the displacive stuff, the Widmanstetten ferrite.
And the game is to see how your cooling path intersects those curves.
Precisely. It's a race against temperature. The model just does the calculus. It integrates the growth of the ferrite as the temperature drops. If the weld cools slowly, you spend more time in that upper C curve, you get lots of boundary ferrite.
Cool it fast, you dive through it and hit the lower curve.
And you get the plate-like structures. It's just pure math, integrating growth rates over time.
So the big question, does it work? They tested it against real-world data from a study by Evans, looking at welds with different amounts of silicon and manganese.
And this is where we see the messy reality of science. The authors point out a flaw in the data. They wanted to see the effect of silicon, but in the samples, the carbon content wasn't perfectly constant.
Ugh, that's so annoying if you're trying to isolate a variable.
It is, but it led to a really important insight, something we can call the silicon paradox.
Okay, walk us through this. This is where the chemistry gets tricky.
Well, conventional wisdom, based on lab tests at a constant temperature, said that adding silicon speeds up ferrite formation.
More silicon, more ferrite, faster. Simple rule.
In the lab, yes, but the model predicted something different for welding, for continuous cooling. The model showed that silicon increases the periequilibrium carbon concentration.
Okay. What does that mean in simple terms?
It effectively raises the transformation temperature.
Wait, if it raises the temperature where it starts, that means it starts sooner when the metal is hotter, right?
Yes.
So shouldn't that mean it has more time to grow? Shouldn't that just confirm the old rule?
You would think so. That's the paradox. It starts forming sooner, but. And this is a huge but. Because the carbon concentration is higher in the austenite right at the boundary, the driving force changes. Remember our crowded nightclub.
The carbon blocking the exit.
Right. Silicon makes that crowd at the exit even denser. So even though the door opens earlier at a higher temperature, the crowd is packed so tight, it's actually harder for the ferrite to grow. The break is stronger.
That is wild. It starts earlier, but it moves slower.
Effectively, yes. The model showed that just applying simple rules from lab tests to a weld fails. You can't just say silicon makes it faster. You have to run the complex calculation.
Context is everything. What works in a static lab doesn't work in the dynamic freezing of a weld.
And the implication is huge. The model suggests high silicon might favor that blocky allotriomorphic ferrite at the expense of the tough acicular ferrite we want.
So blindly adding silicon, thinking you're helping, could actually weaken the weld.
It could.
Wow. So the model makes this bold claim, but did the math hold up? They have this graph, figure one. I'm looking at it now.
Describe it for us.
It's a plot of calculated volume fraction versus measured volume fraction. X-axis is reality, y-axis is the prediction. If it's perfect, all the dots land on a 45-degree line, a unit slope. And the data points are clustered incredibly tightly around that line. The correlation coefficient is 0.96.
0.96.
For our listeners in social sciences, 0.6 is a party, 0.96. That just seems suspiciously good.
In material science, considering all the complexity, hexagonal prisms, carbon diffusion, competing phases, 0.96 is phenomenal. It captures that transition almost perfectly.
And it wasn't just the percentages, it also calculated the size of the original austenite grains.
It did. The mean difference was only about 0.05 to 0.09 micrometers, a microscopic margin of error.
This feels like the big aha moment of the paper.
It is. It validates the whole measured analysis approach. It proves you don't need fudge factors, arbitrary numbers you plug in to make the equation work. The theory itself is robust enough to handle the chaos.
So what does this all mean for us? Why should you care about hexagonal prisms and carbon?
Well, think about how engineering was done before this. It was trial and error. You want a stronger steel, mix a batch, weld it, break it, see what happens.
Repeat 100 times.
Exactly. It's expensive, it's slow. This model represents the shift from metallurgy as an art to metallurgy as a predictive science. You can run 1,000 simulations on a computer in the time it takes to do one weld. You can design alloys to generate that tough acicular ferrite, knowing exactly how much silicon or manganese to add to hit that C curve just right.
It turns the periodic table into a precise toolkit, not just a spice rack where you throw things in and hope.
That's a perfect way to put it.
But I want to leave you with one final thought. Remember those microphases we kind of skipped over? The Martin site.
The leftovers.
The paper ignores them because the volume is small. And that works for this. But
Yeah.
in today's ultra-high strength steels, those tiny pockets of brittle martensite, they can be the starting point for a fracture.
You're hitting on a really critical point.
So the model is great for the 95%, but as the 5%, it ignores the part that could actually fail.
Exactly. It raises the question, how much precision do we sacrifice for a workable model? We have this amazing tool with a 0.96 correlation,
Yeah.
but as we push materials to their absolute limits in deep sea pipelines, in aerospace, will we need to stop ignoring the leftovers?
That's the never-ending pursuit, isn't it? You solve the big picture and then you have to zoom in on the cracks.
Always zooming in.
Well, that is all the time we have for this deep dive. Next time you look at a bridge, just remember, holding it all together is a frozen honeycomb of hexagonal prisms fighting for space in a microscopic race against time.
And a whole lot of math.
And a whole lot of math. Thanks for listening.